Deborah, you're writing as a novelist about subjects that you know a lot about as a historian, the history of magic and Elizabethan England. What made you want to write about alchemy and magic as a novelist?
Well, it's certainly not something I ever planned on doing. It really came over me all of a sudden when I was on vacation and just was really struck by how very popular the otherworldly creatures, witches, vampires, things that go bump in the night, alchemy, magic were to a modern popular reading audience. And it really got me sort of thinking about, you know, the practicalities of what historians of science call kind of worldview. I mean, that's what I do for a living. I study how people in the past looked at the world around them and made up stories to explain what they saw. And I just kept thinking, but wait a minute, you know, from a worldview perspective, if there really are vampires and witches, what do they do for a living? Where do they live? How do they date? Where do they hang out? I never see them. How come? And it was that set of very practical historian of science sort of questions that led me to finding answers in an unlikely way, which was to kind of make up a person. Okay, so here's a witch. And pretty soon those characters were walking and talking and going to interesting places, and I was writing a novel.
Well, when the first novel opens, your character, Diana Bishop, a young witch and also a historian, is standing in Oxford's Bodleian Library looking at a very old manuscript. Now, you've spent a lot of time doing just that in just that place. Does it feel like a magical place?
It does. The Bodleian Library really does make you believe in magic. Just the atmosphere of the place seems very charged, and there's something very magical about picking up a book and leafing through it and seeing at the bottom of a page, you know, Henry VIII's signature or a letter from Queen Elizabeth I or something else that you hadn't expected to find there. So it's the best part about being a historian, for me at least.
The manuscript Diana has called up when the book opens is an alchemical manuscript from the 1500s, and it turns out to be this mysterious, long-lost, enchanted manuscript that then brings a whole world of trouble down under her head. What happens? So there actually were or are alchemical manuscripts like that, and that's what you've spent a lot of time studying. Can you take us back to that world? I mean, we're talking about a time when men and women of letters seriously believed in magic, and when magic and science weren't that far apart?
That's right. Back in the 15th, 16th, 17th century, really all the way down through, including Isaac Newton, people believed that the parts of the material world were connected, that they were linked together, that substances grew and changed into other substances. In some ways, it's a little bit like evolutionary biology, but applied to metals or applied to chemical substances instead of to living organisms. And the belief was that if given enough time and the right conditions, you could somehow hasten the natural process of growth and change that was all around you in the world. So that the most common example is taking in an inferior metal like lead and growing it into gold, improving it into gold. So it's an amazing story that they told about how one thing could become something else.
But you know, as you talk, what I'm getting the sense of a way of looking at the world in which the world was enchanted, you know, in which magical transformations and things could happen. The world, I don't know, maybe felt more alive. Is that accurate at all?
In the case of alchemy, what they believe is that this is a naturally occurring process. The world around you is very alive. Yes, it's very enchanted. It's very interconnected. But it doesn't necessarily require that kind of supernatural agency that we often think of when we think of magic. Mm-hmm. You know, there didn't need to be a spell to make those changes happen. It was certainly more vitalistic. I think people looked around them and did feel connected in ways they didn't always completely understand that seemed somewhat mysterious. So that wise people, witches, alchemists who somehow had a handle on what those changes were all around them, it could somehow manipulate or influence them, were seen of it as being enormously powerful in the time period.
It was also kind of an early form of science, right? I mean, they were doing, it was in some ways, like the birth of chemistry. They were doing real hands-on science experiments.
Absolutely. It is really the birth of modern chemistry, of modern pharmacology, because so many of the things alchemists were doing were as a preparatory step to making medicines. So chemical medicine really came into being in the 16th century, which, of course, continues on through today. So it's the why I am so fascinated by this period. And one of the reasons I wanted Diana and Matthew to go back into the past in the second book in the trilogy is it's such a fascinating way of looking at the world to see that world in which science and magic are not in opposition, but are actually cooperating. So that's pretty exciting.
Some of your scenes of daily life in Elizabethan England are just so vivid. You've got smells, sights, clothing, texture, color, light. Could you, you know, maybe pick one scene and tell us how you fleshed it out? I mean, what choices and decisions you made?
The decisions I had to make for Shadow of Night were interesting ones because I kept running into obstacles. You know, again, this is my period. So I was feeling, you know, fairly cocky and assured when I started writing the novel. And I immediately thought, wait a minute, I've never touched an Elizabethan coin. I know nothing about what the Elizabethan coins look like. So that sent me scurrying off, just finding one thing after another that I didn't know about, whether it was the coinage, what you ate in the winter when the ground was frozen, what exactly the order was that you put on undergarments.
So are you now at the point where you can close your eyes and pick a location and conjure up in your head what it would be like, almost like a movie scene, what it would be like to be there in an Elizabethan drawing room or walking down a city street?
You know, I can, and I can do that in part because I've written this novel. I wrote a nonfiction book called The Jewel House that was on science in Elizabethan London. And so I knew the city, again, really pretty well. But it wasn't until I actually had to put people in it walking around and realize things like, oh, that's where all the traffic jams were. And that's where you would have had to go to get your bread baked because ovens weren't permitted in private homes. And so everybody had takeout. Just learning little bits of what, again, that sort of, you were saying, the smells and the texture of life was all about makes it now possible for me, when I think of Elizabethan London, to think about it in a completely different way, in a way that's very three-dimensional. And for a historian of the 16th century, it's an amazing experience to discover after all of the research that really it was the moment when I took a leap into the imaginative that I actually began to fully understand the period and the place that, you know, ostensibly, again, you know, quote unquote, I knew best.
It sounds like fiction writing is a kind of alchemy.
It absolutely is. You know, I can locate the little lumps of lead in my scholarly life, the frustrations I've had, and I can see where they've been alchemically transformed. So Matthew Royden, I wrote my master's thesis on a poem called The Shadow of Night, and it was dedicated to a man named Matthew Royden. I tried to find out about Matthew Royden. There wasn't much to find, and he was an enormously frustrating character because he knew everybody. He was everywhere. Every time he turned around, there was Matthew Royden, but you couldn't really find out about his background. I couldn't figure out when he died or where. And that frustration, when I was thinking about who would a vampire be and what would they do for a living and who would they hang out with, I thought, they'd be like that Matthew Royden guy from my master's thesis, kind of hanging around the great and famous, but frustratingly not in the spotlight long enough that you could get a fix on him. And so when they go back in time, Matthew Claremont becomes Matthew Royden. That's his identity in the past. So the alchemy of the project is taking what are scholarly frustrations and turning them into fictional possibilities. And that's a pretty nice way to deal with your frustration, I must say.
You know, clearly today, books about magic are powerfully appealing, and not just to kids. I mean, your books are proof that you can write books about magic for adults and they stay on the bestseller list for a very long time. I'm just curious about what your thoughts might be about why we love these so much.
It's such a great question, Anne, and I thought about it a lot more, actually, since Shadow of Night. And, you know, I think that there's a way in which these creatures are monsters to think with. And what I mean by that is that we find it possible for us to park a lot of our own anxieties and concerns onto these beings. The price you pay for secrets, or the ways in which being different is really challenging, and what price you pay in society if you're trying to pass as something that you're not.
Or how to make sense of somebody who seems to transform and become something you didn't think they were.
Exactly. Or somebody who is hiding from themselves because they just can't face who they are, right? So I think back to the 90s. You know, my vampires and witches are Anne Rice's. And I, you know, in the late 80s and 90s, what spoke to me when I read those books was how much they were about power and sex and violence and ruthlessness. A lot of the things that we were very concerned about in that period.
Then what do you make of the fact that you aren't the only contemporary author to write best-selling novels that involve manuscript-based magic, you know, that call up the magic of Oxford and Cambridge and old libraries and crumbly manuscripts with hidden secrets. What are our underlying worries or concerns?
Well, I think we live in a highly technological age. I'm sitting here, and I've got five, monitors, three telephones, a whole soundboard, and it would seem like the entire world was at our fingertips and that everything is within reach. And yet I think we have a sense that, you know, maybe, just maybe, technology isn't the answer for everything. What if there are secrets to be had that aren't on our smartphones? They're not on the internet. They're locked away in an old book that nobody looks at, that nobody can even find. In the academy, I'm a historian, I'm a professor. There's a lot of talk about, you know, are the humanities dead? Are they relevant anymore in life? And I think resoundingly what the public interest in these kinds of topics means is that, no, the humanities aren't dead. There's still a sense that there's something vital and precious and possibly transformative in old ideas, in books, in libraries, and so many of the things that we may hear on a daily basis. Well, that stuff's dead. It's not important.
See, that's fascinating because, see, I would have said that part of our fascination with magic right now is because we are living in this highly technological age, which you can see as kind of the logical sort of culmination of the history that you study. You look at a time when magic and science were kind of one and the same thing, and then science gradually became more and more materialist rather than mystical. And we see the gains around us every day, you know, in the medicine and the technology and the science that we take for granted and that has constructed the world we live in. But maybe we have a creeping sense that in giving up the old magical worldview, a world that's kind of enchanted and alive in strange ways beneath our feet, maybe we lost something.
Well, I think there is a sense that no matter how much we know or we think we know, there's always perhaps questions that the science and the technology can't answer. We do know more. We have pushed so many things forward. We have a much better command over nature, a better understanding of it, perhaps, than people in the past felt they had. And yet, I think we are still, on an almost daily basis, whether it's, you know, Hurricane Isaac or whether it's wildfires, earthquakes, we're still not in control. And magic, in some ways, promises to be the ultimate technology, doesn't it? Because it's a supernatural technology. So on the one hand, I think it's about a wish for even greater levels of mastery than science or technology can provide. And another way, I think it's about a kind of nostalgia, that there would be a kind of knowledge that might be wrapped up in these books that might provide some kind of answers about who we are, why are we here, how do we make a better future for ourselves? Mm.
You know, I was going to ask you whether you believe in magic and the supernatural personally, but I think the better question is there a kind of thinking person's way to see the world as still magical.
Well, I think there is. I try never to personally disagree with either Einstein or Newton, and they certainly, both of them, believed that there was a great deal more to the world than science could possibly explain. You know, whether it's Einstein saying what we see is just one facet on a crystal, and we're not seeing the rest of it, or somebody like Newton who could develop a form of calculus in 18 days and spend 18 years on a single alchemical experiment because he felt that the alchemy was really going to unlock the secrets of the world. And as someone who failed calculus pretty resoundingly, I have to agree with him that alchemy makes a great deal more sense in some ways. There's nevertheless a kind of way in which I think a thinking person can look around and think there are still mysteries, mysteries of time, mysteries of space, mysteries of the human body and how it functions, that we're only just beginning to scratch the surface of, and that we still have that ability to be amazed and taken aback at the complexity of what's around us and what we still don't know. And I think that's what magic is all about. It's rooted in that sense that what you see around you, you still don't have a complete explanation for.
Deborah, thank you so much for talking.
Well, you're so welcome. It's been a pleasure.